Good afternoon. This is Bruce.
Hey, Bruce. This is Trey Elling with 104.9 The Horn in Austin, Texas. How you doing today?
I'm doing spectacular. Thanks for asking.
Cool. Well, thanks again for the time. And I know you've been to Austin a number of times in the past. What do you enjoy most about this city, and do you have any good stories from your time here in Central Texas?
I have good stories from hanging out as a jackalope too much. That's I will say that.
Lots of fun pictures on the walls there.
Yeah, it's the coolest town in Texas, other than four other cool cities. You know, I mean, but it's the most laid back Texas town, I think. San Antonio's pretty laid back too, but like Dallas isn't so laid back, and Houston's not really laid back because they're too busy. In Houston, they're too busy tearing up the roads and building freeways. I mean, it's amazing, and Dallas is pretty busy too. But Austin, they like to have fun. They like to kick back, and they've always come out. Austin has always been, you know, the Alamo Draft House. I've been going to that place forever, and it was just a blast of a place to go. We're going to see how that pans out.
I would imagine that some of the horror movies that you've made over time, and obviously October is your wheelhouse. You're able to do so much with people just eating up things like The Evil Dead and Army of Darkness and some of the other very entertaining movies that you've made over time. But the Draft House was one of those original places that was leaning hard into those types of movies.
They liked weird movies. The Draft House always played cool movies, kitschy movies, retro movies, old movies. They're kind of just movie lovers. Tim League, who I knew over there for years, just great lovers of movies. And they pioneered a system where you go have fun while you're watching movies. You know, it's not your dad's way to watch a movie. You want beer, pizza, pound on the table, make noise. It's the way to go. I never saw anything like it at the time. And now there are a lot of other outfits are trying to sort of emulate that experience. But we're going to have to see what's going to happen to our theatrical friends.
Yeah, hopefully we can get back to a point where we are able to sit in crowded theaters once again. But you're doing something really cool at the Paramount with a showing of Evil Dead followed by a conversation with you. And even though the Paramount is obviously respecting social distancing, there are people who are eating these tickets up. There aren't a whole lot of seats just yet. That has to feel pretty good that even in these COVID times, that people are pretty enthusiastic to come out and see you.
Well, I'm always very appreciative of that, of course. We want people to be safe and to feel safe. And look, these theaters and venues, they do take the time, they do the efforts, and we'll all be conscientious about it. Because here's the thing, I don't think any of us want to get shut down again.
No.
Regardless of where you live, what you do, what your political persuasion is, we want to get back to doing what we're doing. So we'll see. I guess if we're compliant, we get through a long winter, you know, maybe this will happen. But it's kind of bizarre. Sometimes we have to book a larger venue to get the correct amount of seats available to sell. So it's been an interesting thing that you can't sell to capacity. So that's another thing that we'll see how that plays out.
No doubt about that. And I think that places like Texas, I'm assuming Oregon to a degree as well, are better off than what's been going on in California over these last 7 months now too.
Yeah, a lot of it, you know, depends on how much population you have in your state. If you're a very populated state, you're going to have more problems than rural parts of the country. You know, I just drove through eastern Oregon to Boise, and, you know, they don't have the issues there because they don't have the people.
That's right. In researching for this interview, and as someone who has seen the original Evil Dead a number of times, it was interesting to read about how chaotic things were in making this movie back in late 79 and early 1980. In your autobiography, you described the film's production as a comedy of errors and 12 weeks of mirthless exercise and agony. What stands out in your mind the most when thinking back on making this cult classic?
I was just recounting the other day of how many people were injured making the movie in different ways. I twisted my ankle so bad, it's probably sort of broken, you know, but we kept shooting. I was running down a hill and just that thing popped on me, but there we are in the middle of shooting, so you just keep going. And I know there's one particular scene in the movie where I can watch myself limping across the room because we filmed it right after this happened.
Oh, man.
Sam Raimi got hit by a log that was being held up into place that some rigging snapped and a log smashed him in the head. He was chased by a deer My brother Don fell off a cliff when we were scouting locations and fell about 20 feet off a cliff to the forest floor. Another buddy of mine jumped out of the rafters of the cabin we were shooting in, landed on a 2x4 that had a spike sticking up to it. It went right through his foot. He had to grab his leg and like force it off of the spike, and he just limped away. We didn't see him again for about 3 days. I mean, we wrecked a rental car. We ruined a camera housing to a very expensive Aeroflex camera. Nobody wanted to rent to us after that because we brought the equipment back in terrible shape.
So real life was mimicking the art that you guys were in the process of creating, huh?
Yeah, I think we were just being method filmmakers. Like, it had to be bad in order to seem bad.
Is it true that Raimi and somebody else were poking your ankle with a stick after you heard it?
Yeah, that's right, because that's what you would do in a Lord of the Flies kind of scenario where everyone turns on each other. We were so delirious at that point. They cornered me in the corner of a room, and they each had sticks. I'm like, what are you guys going to do with that? And they just started poking me in the ankle, and it was so absurd to me, I started laughing. And they thought because I was laughing, I thought it was funny and I was enjoying it. But I thought it was so absurd that they're making fun of my plight and making it worse. So, yeah, that's kind of what that shoot was like.
That's wild. So filming occurred in a forest outside a small town in Tennessee, with a lot of the action occurring in and around a real-life abandoned cabin. Were you and the crew really sleeping in that cabin at night after wrapping for the day? And if so, just how bad were those living conditions?
Well, we traded off, because what happened is we had some theft out at the cabin one night. We went home during the middle of the night to eat what would be our lunch at about 2 o'clock in the morning, but some locals snuck into the cabin and stole the power tools. And, you know, right next to the power tool was a $20,000 Aeroflex camera. They didn't touch that because they didn't need that. They needed power tools. So, but we realized that this cabin was being sort of scoped out at night. So we each took turns sleeping and shivering by the fire until the next day of filming. So yeah, it was rough and ready.
On nights where you were taken back to the hotel after filming, I also read that you had to ride in the back of a pickup truck because you were so covered in blood from the day. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I'd stick to the seats, and it made any interior space undesirable. So we had this white pickup truck, so they would just throw me in the back of the pickup truck. And we came back on a Sunday morning as people were coming out to get in their cars to go to church. And I looked like a serial killer. And the looks of these people clutching their King James Bible is unmistakable. As they watched me, it was all in slow motion. They watched me as we're going past. And I was like, good morning, good morning. Yeah, it was a weird time. And in order to get it off me, I had to step directly into the hot shower with all the clothes on. Because that all you needed was time and heat.
Yeah, and just let the hot water pelt you for a good probably 15 to 20 minutes.
Good times.
So you were also helping the crew with prepping shots and helping to set up props when not on camera, while also putting your family's Michigan property up as collateral to help finish the movie and blow it up for a 35mm film. Was this due to your belief in what y'all were creating, or was this more a matter of not knowing any better?
It was a little of both. As a producer, you know, me and Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert, we're the executive producers. We're responsible for trying to get this movie made. So, you know, when you're 21, you ask your parents to do stuff like that. And the three of us had no family, had no girlfriends, had no children. So we could be as reckless as we wanted to be. But you had to still do it. It's one thing to talk about it. We had the guts or the balls or the stupidity or whatever you want to call it to do it and to not stop. And the first movie took really 3 years of stopping and starting and stopping and starting, but we never gave up. So that's a lot of it. Young filmmakers today have a little bit of an easier time with all the digital stuff, and it's easier to get your film shown in a movie theater, et cetera. But you still have to do it. A lot of filmmaking is just work.
Is that the biggest risk you've ever taken as a filmmaker? Obviously, it takes big swings to accomplish huge things, and you guys nailed it with this. And despite the fact that there was maybe a little bit of a difficult time selling it first, once Stephen King is on board, obviously, it does get a theatrical release after that, and it's lived on for 40 years now. Is that the biggest risk you've ever taken in film?
Oh, of course. because we were willing to do it. Well, look, it's your first movie. I think a lot of people would be willing to do just about anything to get a movie in a theater. And it's funny. It took 6 years to break even and even more to make money for the investors. But to me, when I finally saw that at my local movie theater at a Saturday matinee with about 30 people in the audience, I was like, this is it. This is where I saw the Poseidon Adventure. Now our movie is here. We have made it. I mean, everything else was gravy after that. We just wanted to get in a doggone movie theater.
How surreal was it when Stephen King actually did come out saying that he loved the film? And have you ever spoken with Stephen about either that movie or just the genre in general?
We haven't, and I still owe him a big handshake when I see him, or a Corona elbow handshake. He not only helped with the first one because he wrote a good review of the movie, and it silenced a lot of the early critics. And then the reviews after his review, it's like they looked at the movie with new eyes and they all liked it more. So, but he was also responsible. We were having trouble finding the money for Evil Dead 2. He's filming in North Carolina with Dino De Laurentiis. Somebody mentions to Stephen King we were having trouble getting the money for it. Stephen King goes, well, I'll tell Dino. He turns to Dino De Laurentiis, says, hey, these guys need money for Evil Dead 2. You should invest. And Dino goes, okay. So we were done. So he helped us twice. I owe him two hearty handshakes.
That's incredible. And I know you talked about injuries a little bit earlier in this conversation. How'd you guys go about getting the final shot in the film when you're attacked by that one surviving demon?
In the first Evil Dead you're referring to?
Yes.
Well, there have been many stories, most of which are lies. The biggest lie that we told for years was that Sam Raimi had a motorcycle and he mounted the camera to a motorcycle. Because at the end of the movie, you follow this demonic entity through the woods. It's a roving POV and it comes to the back of the cabin, goes through that door, goes through the middle door, goes to the front door, comes right up to my face and we cut to black. That's the end of the movie. It's a great shot. And we didn't know how to do it. So we figured Sam would ride a motorcycle, tape the camera to the motorcycle and just run into me. And we'd do it last, so if anybody got hurt, it would be the last shot that we did. So that was one of the big lies that was perpetuated, and I've chosen just to keep perpetuating that lie.
So what's the truth then?
Sam had to kind of run into me, but he didn't do it with a motorcycle. He had the camera in his hand and just ran through the cabin, and at periodic places, the crew members would pull on doors that were, you know, rigged to break apart. And then as soon as the third door broke, he just shouted, Bruce, and that's when I turned. And he just shoved the camera up in my face. And so it's a great shot with a really wide-angle lens. It's a cool, dynamic shot.
All right, I guess we'll play one more round of true or false then. Did Sam Raimi burn the cabin down after you guys were done filming The Evil Dead?
We almost did by accident. We took all the garbage from the film shoot and put it in a huge pile back behind the cabin and lit it on fire. And it got about 30 seconds close to being out of control. We had to do heroic dive bombs with our jackets and water to contain it. But it did burn down eventually, probably 5 years later. Hmm. People collect the bricks from the sandstone fireplace that's still on private property in Tennessee. So stay away, please.
So I read that there was also that the crew created a time capsule and buried it underneath the chimney, maybe. Maybe that's part of the reason why people
are
still...
No, it was where the cellar, where we dug the cellar out. We buried it there.
Do you remember what was in that?
Oh, there's all kinds of great stuff. Burned out light bulbs that we had used in the lights. We called it... There was that gaffer's tape. It's the silver duct tape.
Mm-hmm.
We had styrofoam... piece of a fake board that was used that Ash broke over his girlfriend's head. So we had a bunch of really random stuff, and Sam wrote a cryptic note, and we put it in a cigar box and buried it. So it's still there somewhere.
Hmm. Bubba Hotep is one of my all-time favorite films of yours. Where does that one rank for you in terms of everything that you've done over the last 40 years now?
That's pretty high. Joe Lansdale wrote a really cool story. Don Coscarelli is a very interesting filmmaker, contemporary filmmaker, because he was doing Phantasm just about the same time we were doing Evil Dead. So that was very appealing to us, or to me, you know, to work with a guy like that. I was not familiar with Joe's work, but I felt that he wrote not only an interesting screenplay story, but a kind of a touching one. You know, it's almost a little weepy at the end because Elvis, who the real Elvis, teams up with a guy who thinks he's JFK, and they heroically defend a rest home from a soul-sucking mummy. I mean, stories like that don't come along very often.
That's incredible.
You know what I mean? And and that's why I didn't want to do another one. There were efforts to make another one, but I never felt that the scripts achieved what the first Joe Lansdale one did.
Good for you for exhibiting that judgment. That's a very difficult thing in that business.
Yeah, look, it's easy to make sequels because it's the obvious thing to do, but I know what's going to happen. You'd make one and people would go like this. It's okay. It's not as good as Bubba Hotep, but it's okay. And who needs that? Let it be a special little treat.
How'd you end up doing the DVD commentary as the Elvis character for Bubba Hotep?
I just thought it'd be fun because if we're pretending that Elvis is still alive, let's have the real Elvis, who's still alive now, watch the movie and not necessarily like it. And we interrupted him with phone calls, you know, to do stuff, food orders and things to do. So, yeah, it was fun. We just said, let's leave the track open and he'll just watch and react.
I was surprised to read that you had auditioned for the role of Shooter McGavin in Happy Gilmore. Now, Christopher McDonald was awesome in that role, and it's hard to imagine someone else playing that part, but I kind of feel like you would have done a great job as Shooter. Do you feel that way, too?
I don't even think I auditioned for that, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
That's internet lore.
IMDb lying to me, then.
This happened.
Then let me ask you about this, because I also read that you tried out for the Goldblum part in Jurassic Park, the Keanu Reeves part in Speed, and
not true,
and the Richard Gere part in Pretty Woman?
Not true.
All right, IMDb is just lying all over the place then.
Well, they're just misinformed. Let's give them some credit.
Okay. So one thing that I think is true is that you're playing President Richard Nixon in the upcoming film 18 and a Half. How'd you prepare for that one?
Correct. But now, that's correct. Well, it's funny. The filmmaker, I was talking with him about being in the movie, but there was a fight sequence, and I had just had some eye surgery, and I wasn't sure if I could exert myself for an extended fight scene so quickly after surgery. So I said, I don't think I can do it. So I bagged out on it and he called me back and he goes, well, look, the last 18 minutes of this movie is you're going to hear the tape playing while the rest of the plot plays out. He goes, you want to be Nixon? I went, well, yeah, sure. Let's do that. So we did a Zoom session with me as Nixon and John Cryer as some of the other characters. And my buddy Ted Raimi came in to do a voice or two. So that was a blast. So I played Ronald Reagan now, and I've done Nixon. So we'll see who's next.
Speaking of Ted Raimi, I read that you guys have a comedy album coming out.
We do. It's called The Lost Recordings. It's as though a great researcher, Lames Gipton, has gathered these never-before outtakes from the Golden Era and White House Oval Office recordings and private conversations that happen to be recorded, actors freaking out, stuff like that. So it's a mixed bag that this collector has recorded. And so Ted and I do, you know, 47 voices each. It's just the two of us. And it's a big extravaganza. You know, we're recreating scenes from the Maltese Falcon and, you know, Star Wars, famous stuff.
I love how, and I know this isn't technically radio necessarily, but audio is kind of returning to that theater of the mind mindset from back in that
awesome.
Era.
Believe me, we simulate old camera sounds, old stage doors, old slates. We'll make something sound like it's mono, not stereo. We add optical pops and hums, you know. So yeah, there's a lot you can do. So we've had a blast doing it, and it'll be out hopefully by the end of the year.
Very cool. We'll be looking out for that one for sure. And last thing for you, Bruce, you're called the best reverse actor in the business. What exactly does that mean, and why are you so good at it?
It's a silly concept. Is Sam Raimi, in order to accomplish, like, let's say, a demon's tongue going into your mouth at a high rate of speed, you might start with the tongue in your mouth and then pull it out, so that when you reverse it, it looks like it would go in your mouth very quickly with no strings or wires or whatever. So you have to reverse your reaction. So you have to start, if it's in your mouth, you have to start full horror. And then as it's pulled out, you have to go from seeing it and then being afraid of it and then wondering what you're looking at the beginning. So it's reverse acting.
Wow.
And only weird directors like Sam Raimi require stuff like that.
Why are you so good at it?
He accused me of being a terrible reverse motion actor. I said, Sam, you're the only guy who would ever want it. So that's an invalid argument.
Oh, that's funny. That just speaks to how good of friends you guys are, I guess, going back to your childhood.
Or how much of a jerk director he is. One of the two.
Or that, one of the two. He is Bruce Campbell, an actor whose credits include The Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, Bubba Hotep, the first three Spider-Man movies, Burn Notice, and so much more. He's in Austin on Halloween afternoon for a screening of The Evil Dead, followed by a conversation with the man himself about his career in film and TV. Limited tickets are still available at austintheater.org. Bruce, thank you so much for the time today, man. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate people coming out. We'll be safe and happy, so we'll see you then.
Safe travels, Bruce.
Thank you, my friend. Have a good one.
You too. Take care.
Ciao.